Well, it has been a very dramatic week here. I'm Becky at Ask an Atheist with Sam Mulvey, and, well, I'm hosting today, and we got Tom in the studio. Tom, you were with us on Election Day.
Hi, Becky. Yes, I was.
And a newcomer to the show, Justin, how are you?
I'm doing quite well, thank you.
Was it a dramatic week for you guys? It certainly felt dramatic to me.
It was Tuesday.
Tuesday was enough drama for the entire week?
I'd prepared myself for the worst. And I got what I wanted, which was to be pleasantly surprised.
Okay, all right. It was really a first for the crew of Ask an Atheist, and more broadly, the volunteers involved with Radio Tacoma and KTQA, to have a simulcast live coverage event of the elections from one of the local establishments in Tacoma. We were at the Swiss, along with the folks from the Tacoma Creates campaign. And it was really an interesting and fun time to be there and see all of the different things coming around. And, you know, it's a little bit disappointing sometimes being in Washington, because we're still voting. You can still drop your ballots in at 8 o'clock when things have been announced on the other side of the country, right? Justin, you joined us for a little bit at the Swiss.
Yeah, I got there late, but it was a beautiful thing to see, the way you guys had the system all set up with the research station up top and the whole thing in the bottom area. It was very nice.
So now, as part of Ask an Atheist, we get to delve in a little bit more to some of the issues or elections or results that are of particular interest to atheists or humanists or generally people who think that government should be, you know, established in a secular way. So there have been some good things that happened from the humanist front this week. The 2018 midterm election results mean that once sworn into office, there will be 47, count them, 47 openly non-theist or humanist elected officials at the federal and state levels. Washington has had already two open agnostics serving in the state house, Beth Dolio from District 22-2 and Strom Peterson from District 21-1, both of whom won their re-election bids. Though results have yet to be certified, it appears that Mona Das from District 47 is eking out a win against Republican Joe Fain by just a couple hundred votes. And Das was endorsed by the Freethought Equality PAC as someone who was raised in a traditional Hindu household but is now non-religious. Mike Bell, an agnostic, and Jen Goulet and James Thomas, both atheists, failed to win their elections last week. They sought to represent their districts in the state House of Representatives.
Every vote counts.
It definitely counts. And in this case, every vote counts for folks that are at this point going to be governing from a non-religious angle, a non-religious perspective, you know, whether it's with appreciation for religious pluralism, setting aside their own personal, you know, religious or spiritual beliefs, or from the perspective of just being an atheist, that, hey, this is our work to be done now here in this life.
I'm still wonder why it is that it feels like we have to have a secular beachhead in government when government was founded on this.
You'd think that the government was founded on this. There are some folks that
It's right there in the Bill of Rights.
Wouldn't it be nice if people...
The religious test, that's the Constitution itself, right? Yeah. I'm sorry?
I said, wouldn't it be nice if people had that understanding from the get-go?
Yeah.
There were some other kind of notable things from the election, both nationwide and within our own state. So here's some good news. Holocaust denier Arthur Jones from Illinois, we talked about him on the show a little while ago. He lost to the Democratic incumbent 75% to 25%.
But he still got 25%.
Hey, he did. I know, right?
I think 25%. There's a 25% approval rating for smallpox.
Is there now? I thought there was than 25% approval of a flat earth theory.
Oh, yeah, well, true.
And something to the tune of 56,000 votes, I think. People who were able to put his views to the side and vote for party rather than Democrat.
Just because he is an R next to his name. Yeah. And the crazy thing is that the state Republican Party of Illinois didn't even endorse him this time around. I mean, he was not in a district where he would be likely to win as a Republican, but still, to not even get the endorsement of your state party. I mean, I think that they just kind of had their eyes closed or looking elsewhere when this guy made it through the primaries.
Yeah, they did the absolute least that they could do.
Well, at least they didn't endorse him. I mean, that's something.
I'm surprised.
What's interesting, though, is his opponent actually is anti-abortion. So you don't tend to think of too many Democrats as being against abortion because of the general party platform in the national level. But, you know, maybe this is an area where you have to be a little bit more conservative in order mm-hmm. to make yourself known and electable against a Holocaust denier.
And if ever, if you know, between two parties, one of them is a lot less monolithic than the other.
That is the case. Well, all 10 members of the Congressional Freethought Caucus kept their seats handily, so that's really cool.
Mm-hmm.
Have you guys heard of the Freethought Caucus?
I'm not as read up on it as I would like.
Yeah, I mean, I hear about it here and there, but nothing formal.
You know, it's really new this year or last year, and Jared Huffman was really the founder of it, and Jamie Raskin, he's from I think, New Jersey. None of these guys, they're all men. None of them are atheists or avowed freethinkers specifically, except for Jamie Raskin calls himself a humanist, but also identifies as Jewish with his heritage. But they're just looking at governing or having a caucus that looks at a plurality of religions, the rights and interests of atheists and non-theists within the country, and looking at making sure we've got evidence-based, science-based policy. So that's really cool.
It's good to have somebody looking out.
And it definitely is. And, you know, I can say one of the representatives from California, McNerney, he was at the California Freethought Day back in October. I met him. Wasn't too keen on saying, hey, this is, you know, Representative McNerney, and you're listening to Ask an Atheist. And I can understand, you know, if he's got a reelection, you know, to win.
Right.
But he's a guy that doesn't mind being on paper saying, I'm part of this particular caucus. I am ready to advocate for the interests of these people with these values.
It's unfortunate that the math works out in such a way that those kind of political calculations need to be taken before you can just come out and say, I am this or I am that. You'd be very conscientious of the district that you're trying to represent and who's there and all those kinds of numbers, where it should be a little bit more on its face. People should be able to be honest about what they believe.
And I think, you know, we are the voice of those voters, people listening in perhaps from their district.
And, you know, in Washington State, the voice has actually gotten a lot louder, to the point where Danny Westneat had an op-ed in the Seattle Times saying, hey, it's time to listen to these non-religious voters. We're a huge block.
Yeah.
And so getting that kind of clout or credibility or visibility is huge.
I think I read somewhere, actually shortly before I moved here 3 years ago, that the Puget Sound has more atheists per square inch than anywhere else in the country.
Is that just because we're all stuffed into our tiny micro units and micro housing apartments and things like that?
That's, the population density is a part of it, but I think it attracts people who tend toward the secular.
I think so, too.
How much square footage do we take? Because it's important to remember that we build up to, not necessarily.
True. Cubic feet.
Cubic feet, yeah.
Now, both you guys have experience living in Florida.
Don't remind me.
Oh, yeah. Sorry about that. Were there some highlights from Florida that had to do specifically with religious things, or was that just kind of the normal Florida craziness going on?
I'm not surprised by anything that I've seen out of Florida. I mean, there is a reason that in presidential elections, Florida is seen as a swing state. It's an interesting, social economy down there, where you have people that come in from all around the country and
internationally, for that matter.
Internationally,
big city, you know, Miami and Orlando and Tampa. You got a lot of, you know, immigrant population there.
Yeah, they say Florida's five distinct cultures, you know, depending on what part of the state you're in, and they're really different from each other.
The further north you go, the further south you get.
Oh yeah, I was in Tallahassee. That was Baja, Georgia.
Sorry, I was in Central Florida.
Yeah.
I didn't have it quite as bad.
Well, let's see. We've got 38 non-religious state representatives were elected. Surprise, surprise, none of them are Republicans.
Surprise?
Yeah, to nobody's
sarcasm.
Surprise.
Sarcasm.
So, it's very hard, I think, to be a non-religious Republican candidate, especially when your party platform, either at the federal or the state level, has such religiosity built into it.
No, it's been that way since Reagan, wasn't it? The religious right? Didn't that start
that seems to be, I remember a little bit, I remember in high school in Florida, Central Florida, in the 70s, the first of the I Found It movement, and it was a little before Reagan came in, you started seeing it, you know, at least in that part of the country.
Was it that kind of
Reagan definitely caught the wave.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Well, let's go to Utah for a minute. Todd Zenger lost his state-level election bid in Utah to the incumbent, Patrice Arendt. Zenger had actually sent out a campaign mailer urging Utahans to vote in memory of our God, our religion, our wives, and our children.
Wait, vote in memory?
Yeah, I know.
God? Does that mean that God is dead?
I don't know. Maybe this is the premise for God is not dead. Part four,
right.
One of those hokey movies. But, you know, his platform included these gems like recognizing pornography as the public health crisis that it is, or displaying In God We Trust in all places, or decreasing abortion. But really, you know, he lost his election bid to the incumbent. The incumbent is one of the few, I think the only Jewish representatives in Utah. And his mailer says, vote for me in memory of our God, our religion, our wives, our children.
Who is this us that he is referring to?
Well, as compared to the Jewish incumbent.
Yeah, all Americans, perhaps? Us,
yeah.
Maybe?
So, you know, especially in wake of the Tree of Life shooting in Pittsburgh that was targeting, you know, Jews at a synagogue, that was really seen as inappropriately targeting the religion and the God of and the family of this particular Jewish incumbent.
Yeah, this mailer was sent out like mere days after that, right?
Yeah. It was after the Tree of Life shooting, but before the election. You know, maybe it was just bad timing. You know, unfortunate timing on his
you
part.
Think? I don't
big on God, bag small on tact. Maybe.
Yeah.
So and then but he lost handily. So I guess that's a win for not electing racists that are using their particular religion or anti other religion people. Mm-hmm. Right. But a little bit closer to home, let's go back to Matt Shea. Matt Shea, you guys remember, he's the guy that wants biblical war visited upon secular leaders.
Sounds like a fun guy at parties.
He's the Christian Dominionist, right?
Yes.
Make America safe for theocracy?
I think so, yeah.
Oh,
that's
man.
That. How does that fit on a red hat?
it's going to be a long bumper sticker.
He won his re-election to a sixth term in Eastern Washington, so he's still there. And, you know, a lot of this stuff that really hit the media started at the end of October with a Rolling Stone expose about him, and then hit a lot of the local papers, and then things like the New York Times or Washington Post or Huffington Post at a more national level once his outline for biblical war was really referred and bumped up to the FBI by the local Republican, might I add, sheriff in Spokane County. But it was after ballots had already started getting sent in the
state.
That's
one of the good things and one of the bad things about Washington State is that you can mail your ballot in early, vote early, all those kind of things. It's a system that's good in the way that it promotes more engagement because you have more of a time opportunity to do so, but bad also in a way because if there is late breaking news about a particular candidate from either party and you already voted, there's no take backs.
Yeah, but I don't know. When it comes to last minute late breaking news, you know, October surprises, how many of those are accurate? You know, some of them are.
This guy does not deny that he has his guidelines for biblical war. It's accurate. Now, he says that it's just an outline for a speech and he's made no secret of it and it's not anything, you know, hidden about him, which means that it's accurate, that this is part of what he believes.
Ooh, and that's right. This is coming directly from him, isn't it?
Yep.
At least as it originally.
Yeah. My question would be, how many people actually were aware? How many people in that particular district were aware that he held these views? I mean, he did speeches. He didn't necessarily hide it. But how many people were, while they're going to work and raising kids and having families and having friends and having relationships, all that life, while they were doing that, how many of them were aware and then still voted for him?
Well, for people listening from outside of Washington, East Washington is not West Washington, Puget Sound. Mm-hmm. It's very, very different politics. And it does not surprise me. I'd deeply surprise me if you were from around here, but mm-hmm. he's on the other side of the mountains where there's a lot of that mindset.
Mm-hmm.
There definitely is, especially that close to North Idaho, you know, just over the border. Sheriffs in both North Idaho and then in the Spokane Valley have been keeping an eye for a good long, you know, decade or two on some of the Christian-based separatist groups, the Christian-based white separatist groups, and supremacist groups that are sort of in that area. But I think I'm with you, Justin, a little bit that, you know, how many are just looking at the R next to the guy's name and then putting that as their vote, regardless of whatever his views may be, you know, sort of saying, well, at least we're going to secure more Republicans in state level representation, especially when folks in Eastern Washington often feel overshadowed by the population on the west side of the Cascades.
I don't think it's a good idea as an individual citizen to feel so disenfranchised by democracy that you would go to your worst examples of your party.
Well, certainly in Illinois, they didn't do that with the Holocaust denier.
Yeah, just in Illinois.
So, I don't know, maybe we'll hear about a few more little election updates after the break. This is Ask an Atheist. You can call us at 844-SKEPTIC. That's 844-753-7842. And leave us a voicemail.
Beware squid ink. The Sikasum magnets don't work. You don't run any faster. Warning, they shock you. True fact. Also, they are way too expensive, and all they want is your gold. They are taking over the world, one bracelet at a time.
Mamma mia, here we go again.
Hi, I'm Professor Poopy Pants.
Hello, and welcome back to Ask an Atheist. I think we're picking up the pace a little bit here with our political news and things like that. We still got Justin and Tom in the studio with me. I'm Becky Friedman. And hey, so we talked about some of the good, some of the bad to come out of this election with specific candidates and things like that. But a little bit back to Florida, where you guys have some experience. Let's go all the way down to Alabama. You guys ready for this one?
Mm-hmm.
Roy Moore seems to live on. Everyone's favorite, least favorite
that name.
Teenage dating, disgraced judge. Yeah. Oh, anyway, we'll just get into it. More than 71% of voters in Alabama have approved a ballot measure that will allow the display of Ten Commandments in schools and on other public property while prohibiting the use of public funds to defend the displays or the ballot measure itself against court challenges. The main campaigner for the amendment was Dean Young, who also served as Roy Moore's campaign strategist for the failed one-time Senate candidate and disgraced state Supreme Court justice. Dean reported that the people are super excited to have this opportunity to go down in history as the first state to acknowledge that they want God, that is, the Christian God, in their constitution. And he asserted that this is the first time in the history of the country that a state has taken such a stand in acknowledging the God of the Old and New Testament. Alabama's ACLU chapter said that from a legal standpoint, the constitutional amendment is meaningless and warned that local school districts will be forced to hire lawyers to defend lawsuits challenging specific Ten Commandment displays, leaving taxpayers footing the bill.
Talk about killing two birds with one stone.
What are the birds here in this case?
Well, the birds here are the feel good, I guess, motion of having the Ten Commandments thing on their directly tied in with their state government, and then also forcing school districts to use resources that could be better used towards, you know, educating kids and instead pay lawyers for that.
Do you think they're trying to drain school coffers?
I think that they're trying to starve the beast.
That's an interesting target there that I hadn't actually thought of. When you look at local municipalities being stuck with footing the bill, and in this case, it would be specifically public places, which would be schools, we do know and have seen that a lot of folks associated with the Republican Party, and especially of the Betsy DeVos variety, really do want to drain public resources from schooling in order to allow vouchers, in order to allow charters that might or might not...
Tax-free Bible schools?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good point, because at first blush, it looks like it's words on paper that had no change in the end game of what's been going on, but actually it does.
Mm-hmm.
It's who's paying for it.
Yep. And it's the Alabama isn't necessarily an economic powerhouse.
But anyway, who gets to say whether or not a Ten Commandment display goes into a given school or local?
Well, it does now, given that this has passed, apparently. So they've changed their constitution. There have been lawmakers that have said we're really happy to put and make sure that there are Ten Commandments displays in every single school.
Oh, so every school is going to have a lawsuit.
And every school district's taxpayers are going to have some of the tax money that they are ostensibly paying to go towards the school, where the school has to pay a lawyer instead to defend this this thing.
That's the end game.
So you think the end game really is to drain public schools of resources? Well, is that, or is it just a convenient side effect for these folks that really would like to have the end of secular public schooling in favor of their Bible schools, where they don't have to teach evolution, they don't have to teach sexuality and health education,
and they want to be private?
Does it make a difference?
Well, do they want those schools to be private schools, or would they rather have all children have free and compulsory public schooling in those particular religious values? I mean, that's a scary thought. And that, whether intentionally or just as a side effect, pragmatically, of this particular constitutional amendment, that it could happen. I mean, Alabama's already not known. It doesn't pop up on the lists for, you know, best levels of education, teacher pay, percentage of students going on to, post-secondary education or internships or certification programs and things like that. You guys have planted in me this additional worry. It's not just laughing at the legacy of Roy Moore continuing on in Alabama.
Something else that's interesting about that is if you can get the Supreme Court, have a case go to the Supreme Court and have Supreme Court precedent decided in a particular way in regards to one state. Tom, help me out here. What's the term for when it goes from federal down to state constitutionally?
Is that remanded back down to the lower courts or something?
I'm not sure the term.
I mean, it would apply to all states, wouldn't it?
Yeah. I can't, I'm drawing a blank on the term. It starts with an I, but it would open up the door for other states to start doing the exact same thing that Alabama does, led by the nose of the federal government.
Ooh, that is another thing to be watching out for. Kind of scary stuff. You know, Young, the big proponent of this particular amendment, he actually is predicting that Alabama Governor Kay Ivey, she just won the election over a Democrat, Walt Maddox. Young is saying that he's sure that the governor will do everything within all her available power, and that includes executive orders to ensure that the Ten Commandments are displayed in public venues within 90 days. So, you know, you can think, yeah, they're going to go up in schools, they're going to go up in courthouses. It was Roy Moore that had his Ten Commandments in his courthouse that got him kicked off the Supreme Court the first time.
Yeah, the Establishment Clause is what I was thinking of.
Oh, okay.
Establishment Clause.
So that's kind of a scary thing.
And he wasn't kicked off by the U.S. Supreme Court.
The state Supreme Court. Yeah, he was Chief Justice. He was Alabama Supreme Court Chief Justice. And, you know, he was disgraced and kicked off and then won re-election later. So, and he barely lost his election bid for Senate. And, it was really only, again, the power of, October surprises. It was really the revelation that he had pursued teenage girls when he was well into adulthood in his
30s. 32, 33, something like that.
Right. And had preyed upon high school age girls in a sexual and romantic way that really, eked out the win for his challenger.
Barred from going into malls.
Yeah.
Because of that.
So,
sequestered to the food court.
Let's see. We've got some other political news that, for those of us that are interested and invested in democracy and in a fair, hearing of everything, are kind of worrisome. The day after midterm elections, Donald Trump tweeted that he had replaced Attorney General Jeff Sessions with Matthew Whitaker, Sessions' former chief of staff, as acting attorney general. When Whitaker was running for U.S. Senate in Iowa, he had made it known at a debate sponsored by an anti-LGBT conservative Christian organization that he was concerned with whether judges were people of faith and had a biblical view of justice. And when the moderator requested clarification on whether he meant Levitical law or the New Testament, Whitaker explained that as long as judges have a New Testament worldview, they'd be a good judge, in his opinion. He added at that time, which was 2014, that he would be very concerned about any judge that professed a secular world view. What do you guys make of this Whitaker appointment? I mean, some people are saying that it's illegal because he has never been confirmed, even.
There's a definite case to be made that this appointment was illegal. I don't have the appropriate legal training to be able to lay it all out, but it seems very clear that this is an intensely problematic appointment.
Oh, yeah, on several fronts. I mean, anyone who's, at the very least, he shouldn't be there to start with because it requires Senate approval. And then even if he did have that, he should recuse himself because he publicly stated, you know, made public in public partisan proclamations. Sorry about that. The Mueller's investigation should be shut down. And, you know, that's prejudice.
That's kind of the whole point of an investigation. You're trying to figure out what the truth is, not deciding your truth and then working your way backwards from there. But, hey.
Do you think that there's something aligning with a religious adherence that would maybe think that would compel you to start with what your truth is and then judge investigations based on what that truth is, trying to confirm a pre-existing notion?
That would absolutely do.
And that would seem to be what the entire legal system is designed to avoid.
Well, I mean, you guys were talking a little bit in the pre-show about some of the things, some of Whitaker's opinions of the legal system itself. I mean, we in grade school and in high school learned that there's three branches of government. Those are the checks and balances on each other. And Whitaker seemed to have some interesting views on that, right?
I'd never heard of this guy before his appointment. And so I kind of looked up some of information about him. Yeah, he thinks that the... he doesn't like the judicial branch of the government, feels like it is an inferior branch.
Funny thing for a guy that's acting attorney general.
Well, yeah, and has been a U.S. attorney before himself.
But did you say he thinks that the courts are an inferior branch of government?
That is the word I think I saw that he described them. And specifically that the Supreme Court has no business deciding what is and is not constitutional.
Well, isn't that the whole point of the Supreme Court?
Since 1804, said Marbury versus
Madison. That was decided.
You know, this is back when the founding fathers were in office and the Supreme Court was just getting set up. It wasn't in the Constitution that they did this, but it was immediately somebody's got to decide if it's an ambiguous thing. It isn't explicitly laid out in the Constitution. Somebody's got to decide what's constitutional, what isn't. And it's been the Supreme Court that did it since 1804.
So, Justin, what do you make of this?
What I make of this is less about Matthew Whitaker specifically, but more about the way that people's minds work. If you are the kind of person who has a mindset where you've already decided what something is, you have your truth and you're set in that truth, then you're going to have all kinds of justifications and rationalizations and build your way back from there. What Matthew Whitaker is he's already decided what the truth of the matter is. He does not need these investigations.
And his truth has a capital T.
Yeah, exactly. Truth with the capital T. And that's the problem with the way that he thinks about things, the way that he solves his problems. He works backwards. That's not experimentation. That's not trying to find what actually is true and then holding an opinion that accurately reflects what reality is, that is deciding reality.
He doesn't have opinions, he has values.
Oh, scare quotes, values. It's funny how those values seem to shift. I don't imagine that he would be saying the same thing about how he disagrees with Marbury versus Madison and whether or not the Supreme Court has the authority to decide what is and is not constitutional if court cases like Obergefell v. Hodges were decided differently. I'm sure he would have a very different opinion.
Obergefell v. Hodges being the one that actually legalized marriage equality for gay folks and bi folks across the country nationwide, right? So you think that he would actually, you know, say, oh yeah, Supreme Court's awesome, be a little cheerleader for the Supreme Court if they had ruled more conservatively?
He has very romantic language about the historicity and all of the the stories and the lore that we have in as American society about the founding fathers and the Constitution and how we hold up these values and all these kind of things. You can say all that, and that's one thing. But the only thing that you have to do is pay attention to when they switch. When they say things like he's probably noticed, he's probably been aware of the growing sort of way that there is kind of legislation coming from the bench, or at least there's an argument about how there's legislation coming from the bench in the Supreme Court, and he has an issue with that because it's not going the way that he wants it to go. If the Supreme Court was deciding cases that were going the way that he wanted them to go, he wouldn't be saying all this flowery, I'm a constitutional originalist. He wouldn't have those opinions. He'd be like, this is the way that we want things to be.
I think that term legislating from the bench is definitely a dog whistle term of conservative individuals that really don't like when their laws are overturned and said, no, that's not right. That's not in accordance
constitutional
with
grounds.
Same thing with the activist judges term. If you wanted to talk about an activist judge, we could probably do a whole show on this about Scalia deciding D.C. Heller the way that he did. That overturned Supreme Court precedent.
You know, he's wanting to do to have the law be based on a certain set of morality. Thing is about morals, I find I don't trust people who are too moralistic very often. And the ones I do trust, it shows, you know, actually thinking about morals takes work and it's not easy and it doesn't always, you know, you can see a person putting effort into trying to figure it out. It isn't preset, preordained, mm-hmm. truth with a capital T, you know, mm-hmm. this is easy. Oh, and it's also a real good crowbar to get what I want.
Yeah.
You know, it just happens to be, you know, what God said is exactly what I want. Funny.
Convenient.
Yeah.
Convenient.
That takes no work at all. You know, the work goes into using the crowbar.
Do you guys worry at all, you know, when you have someone that says, judges, as long as they're on the bench, I approve them, you know, as long as they are judging and evaluating and analyzing cases from a New Testament perspective.
Well, that rules out certain other religions, doesn't it?
It definitely does. I mean, he's saying that atheists or Jews or Muslim or Hindu judges, basically, he doesn't trust them. So how can an attorney general or acting attorney general, I should say, because since he hasn't been confirmed in his appointment, how can he then trust in the entire system that he is appointed to engage in?
The issue that I have with people like this is, from my perspective, God is not real. And the systems that we build are built by humans. So we have to come at these systems and tweaking these systems as if they were built by humans. Because they were. So the Constitution is a system. The American system is a system that was built by humans. And if this guy's trying to apply this biblical type interpretation to how he wants to view the Constitution, he's going against the entire point of the whole thing.
I mean, I don't know that he is actually somewhere along the line, maybe as a U.S. attorney, he's been an officer in the federal government and probably taken an oath to the Constitution. But it okay, from my perspective, it appears that he wants to overthrow that.
It certainly seems like to me.
And this is back to a system we've seen throughout history. This is not, and we've seen other parts of the world, and we know where this goes.
So I want to know what you guys think of how aligned he is with the teachings and philosophies of Matt Shea, the one who wants his biblical war and biblical justice and things like that. The one who says, you know, kill all tyrants. And by tyrants, we mean those who govern via secular values as opposed to through the values of God. I mean, are we looking at Matt Shea from Spokane County, from Eastern Washington, as the acting attorney general, essentially?
Some people can hide their, I'll use the term Christian radicalism, better than others can. I think Matthew Whitaker is a better chameleon than Matt Shea is.
Or need to. Some people can just come out and say it because people will vote for them regardless
in their
district. Yes. Maybe.
No offense to the voters, maybe
they would vote for him.
Yeah.
It's a little ambiguous, isn't it?
Matt Whitaker strikes me as the kind of guy who wants to appear as though he is in bed with the Constitution, but he's thinking about the Bible the whole time.
Ooh, uh-oh. That's a little image that I don't know that I ever want.
it seems like a very, very tiny portion of the United States are actually, you know, the term dominionist, Christian Reconstructionist, the people who are actually want to see the United States become a theocracy. It seems like a tiny little group of people, but somehow they have gotten a lot of politicians and political activists way up high, and it's like, how are they doing this?
Well, Justin, you had
some
thoughts,
interesting thoughts on that,
on how we've got this representative government that has ballooned the number of really radical thinkers that don't necessarily reflect the majority of humans and voters and residents within our country itself.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I consume a lot of news media, and over the past couple of days since the election, there have been a lot of people who have been talking about the steep hill that the Democratic Party had to climb in order to get to where they did eventually get. But there's a reason that it was so hard to climb that hill. And there have been a lot of people who say things like the Senate is an inherently undemocratic organization. And it is, because you're supposed to only get two senators statewide election per state, up to 100, right? And then the House of Representatives was built in a different framework of it was supposed to be representative of the population instead. And this is in Article 1, Section 2, Clause 3 of the Constitution. Not many people know the Constitution front to back. I certainly don't know it front to back. But what I do know is, in this particular section of the Constitution, there's a supposed to there. And the supposed to is it's supposed to be one representative in the House of Representatives at the federal level to every 30,000 citizens.
Wait. This is from a time in the, 1700s or 1800s, where our state or our national population must have been far below what it is now.
Absolutely. It's written in the Constitution. It is enumerated the original 13 colonies, how many representatives they're supposed to have, at least in the breakdown of the written of the Constitution that I saw. It was enumerated right there, the 13 colonies and how many representatives they had. It was supposed to be based on population. And the Apportionment Act of 1911 was, it's also enumerated that they have, the Congress has a responsibility to reapportion seats in the House as the, using the census data as a starting point to figure out, like, how many people are here, what state's big, what state's small, how you're supposed to use the 1 to 30,000 as a guideline, and then add or subtract representatives from each state in that way.
So the number of representatives to Congress might change, might actually decrease with a decreasing population.
Absolutely. With a decrease in population, then it would decrease it if they're following the 1 to 30,000 thing. The problem is that they're not, because the Apportionment Act of 1911 took effect in 1913. And that capped the number of representatives in the House at 435. And it was made permanent by the Apportionment Act. I think it was called the Permanent Apportionment Act of 1929. Here's the sticky wicket with that. The population of the United States in 1911 was about 90 million people. And the population of the United States in 2018, according to the most recent number I have, is about 325 million people, I think.
So a lot more than in about 100 years ago.
Right. That leads us into the situation where, on average, we have about one representative to every 700,000 citizens.
It's hard to cover all the bases representation-wise, and you're trying to represent that many people all at once.
And there's been a lot of conversation in mainstream media conversations with other people about that, about abolishing the Electoral College. What a lot of people don't seem to realize is, or they do realize, but they realize it in the sort of lies to children way, is that the Electoral College is based off the House of Representatives. So we have literally built in two houses of Congress that are not Democratic.
So you said that the problem is that they don't represent, 30,000 people's interests, but a huge swath of people's interests. Mm-hmm. Why is that so much a problem?
Well, let me lay it out to you this way. If we were following the way that it's written in Article 1, Section 2, Clause 3, to have one representative per every 30,000 citizens, we'd have about 10,800 representatives.
Okay, that just seems ridiculously untenable.
Mm-hmm. So what we should have done, at least in my fairly relatively well-informed opinion, is to have an added layer of complexity not necessarily just the state governments and then the federal government. And there should also have been a restructuring to make it so that the representation of, say, a large state like California or New York is not so cut down and overweighted by North Dakota, Wyoming. Okay.
And you think that this would have prevented some more of these radical voices from you know, injecting themselves into government and policy and things like that?
Oh, absolutely. I would have to recheck the numbers on this, but I want to say that it takes 300 some odd voters in California voting one direction to counterweight the vote of one person voting the other direction in Wyoming.
300 to one?
I believe so. 300 individual citizens. Like, when you break down what the how the mathematics, this is why they don't cover it in a NBC segment, because it's difficult to talk about. But it's something to the tune of a large number of people in California voting one direction has the equal electoral value as one person in this other
in Montana, Montana or Wyoming or some of the smaller populated states.
I'll have to check my numbers on that, but it's very Animal Farm. Some animals are more equal than others.
Wow. Some really kind of scary or interesting things that may or may not have implications for how our governance works, how radical we are as a country or as individuals or as a government. You're listening to Ask an Atheist. We'll be back in a moment after the break.
If you or a loved one have used any squid ink products, then you may be entitled to
addiction to the products,
growing squid arms,
going mentally insane,
losing friends and or family,
and certain death.
If you have been approached by and or seen members of the Squid Ink Corporation, please contact your local Inkerton Detective Agency immediately.
Welcome back to Ask an Atheist with Sam Mulvey, but today it's me, Becky, with Justin and Tom, and we've been talking a lot of politics. I think we're ready to go abroad. Do you guys want to hear some good news from outside of our United States?
I think we all need good news.
Yeah, that's just what I was going to say. Lay it on me.
All right. So Greece's atheist prime minister struck a deal with Archbishop Hieronymus that will remove 10,000 priests from official state payroll to be replaced by public servants that include doctors and teachers. Prime Minister Alex Tsipras has made no secret of his desire to officially separate church and state in the nation where Eastern Orthodoxy is enshrined as the official religion in its constitution. Under the agreement, Greece will annually transfer a state subsidy to a church fund to support priests' salaries.
He's going to have to knock that off. It's making too much sense.
I tell you, I'm glad some country's going in the right direction that way. It's delighted to hear it.
It's an interesting thing because Greece has been having lots of financial struggles, you know, and received a lot of criticism within the EU. Well, one of the biggest assets that Greece has is church real estate, is church property. And so, you know, the fact that Tsipras is an atheist is one thing, but also when he's looking at going towards trying to really disentangle the Eastern Orthodox religion from the state constitution and state interests, he's looking not only to secularize his nation, but also to look out for it financially and sort of help it recover and rescue it.
Is able to walk and chew gum at the same time?
Something like that. And it's pretty neat because, I don't know, I mean, if you had ever thought about in the United States, like, oh, we're going to try and strike a deal to try and disentangle something with some religious stranglehold or some religious benefit, you'd think, no, that's never going to happen. I don't know how Hieronymus gave it up, but that he did. He agreed to it.
It won't happen unless we make an effort to make it happen.
So, good on Greece. Another good thing from abroad, still in Europe, Scottish schools will be the first in the world to globally embed LGBTI inclusive issues within all state school curricula. Among the topics covered will be the history of gay rights movements, how to tackle homophobia, transphobia, and anti-LGBT bullying, and sexual identity in general. No exemptions or opt-outs will be available. The move marks a full turnabout from just 40 years ago when homosexuality was a criminal offense in the country, and from 1988 to 2000 when teachers who taught the, quote, acceptability of homosexuality as a pretended family relationship risked their school actually losing state funding under Margaret Thatcher's now-decried statute known as Section 28.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's very good news for one half of my home countries of Scotland.
Oh, home country. This is part of your heritage.
Yeah, third or fourth generation Scottish.
Nice. So we're looking now actually at Scotland being one of the most LGBT-friendly countries in the world.
About time.
Fantastic.
And from just thinking, you know, within just outside of my lifetime, having homosexuality be explicitly criminalized, you know, I mean, I'm 36 years old, and it means that within one of my, you know, my current lifetime, we've seen this huge turnaround.
And I like that it's there's no opt-out option available. It's baked right into the system.
Yeah, we have all across our 50 states and, you know, different education systems, so many different ways that parents can say, these are my religious values and I'm going to stop my children from hearing about the fact that gay people exist, or I'm going to prevent them from being educated about how their own bodies work as they mature into adult bodies. You know, we have things about, like in Washington State, it is a law that if a district offers comprehensive sexuality and health education, that it be medically and scientifically accurate. But there's not even a requirement that it be offered in the first place. And
really?
Even if it is offered, every parent has the right to preview the curriculum and then opt their child out of it.
Well, it looks like Scotland was paying attention to the things we were doing wrong and made sure that it went correctly. You know, if you're going to do it,
A strange way of looking at things. It's almost as if when you pay attention to what other people are doing, can modify your behavior and thought processes accordingly and come to a better answer.
It beats learning from your own mistakes.
Oh, that is true. Learn from somebody else's.
Yeah.
I wonder, the opt-out part, is it possible for people to opt out of things like mathematics?
You'd think, right? Like, why is sexuality and health education, you know, basic bio class, something you can opt out of? Whereas, you know, oh, my religion doesn't believe in mathematics, so I want to... No, that would be absurd. You're right, Justin. It's absurd to think.
In high school, I opted out of mathematics in a slightly different fashion, but...
Oh, don't get me wrong, so did I.
Yeah.
Like a lot of kids...
I made up for it in college, but yeah.
A lot of kids opt out of PE, but not in any explicitly sanctioned way, right?
Right, right.
I think the way that you can really construct a curriculum where no opt-outs, you know, or excuses or permission to decline, you know, doing this is really, you know, possible is because it's not like... Today we're going to do our sex ed curriculum that's going to include LGBT history. It's that it's embedded throughout the entire curriculum. It's not like it's one day where you can say, well, let's go to the library and, you know, watch Magic School Bus or something like that.
It's almost as if LGBTQI people have been here all along and we're finally recognizing that, or at least Scotland is.
Oh, you think? If only we could do that and make a much more rounded curriculum that includes the perspective and experiences of so many people that have been underrepresented, you know, whether it's non-religious individuals in, you know, as our founding fathers, or Black folk throughout all different parts of history, or people in color, people of color in general, or LGBT people.
A fulsome education? That's just crazy talk.
Well, you know, sometimes when you have lacking education, you get to believe some myths. And to address this, we actually have an email, Bradford from Utah, that says, hey, I've heard for years now that animal shelters won't adopt out black cats around Halloween because of fear they'd be sacrificed in pagan rituals. Is there any truth to this, or is this just like the satanic panic of the 80s? Hey, guys, I love my cats. Tom, you are a cat aficionado as well.
Oh, yes.
You have a few furry friends in your household.
Indeed.
I'm
allergic to cats, but I like cats.
Any black cats in your family history?
Only when I was a small child. It just hasn't worked out that way.
Okay. All right. And you managed to live as a small child with a black cat in your family and not sacrifice it? Atheist you.
No.
So I actually did some...
I like that cat.
I did some interesting research about this. Justin, you had heard this particular rumor, right? That black cats, you can't have them on Halloween or something.
I didn't put too much stock in it, but I wasn't sure which way it went.
It does look like that it is a rumor that is somewhat self-perpetuating, even when you have things like ASPCA or Vet Street or Snopes or the Humane Society saying, no, it really isn't a
thing. I mean, I've heard this is the first time I'm hearing it isn't true.
Okay. So I actually looked at the first thing is black cats. Are they harder to adopt out? Do people not like them? Because I went hoping to get a black cat when I went to go adopt our newest.
But you're a godless heathen.
Yes, precisely. No. And it didn't end up working out. But I did find out that black cats actually account for the highest percentage of feline adoptions. They actually surpass the rate of black cat intake at over 65 pet sheltering agencies across the nation. So that was really surprising, because we hear this thing saying that, well, not as many black cats get adopted, black cats are euthanized at higher rates. It's actually not that black cats are euthanized at higher rates, but more black cats total are euthanized and more black cats are adopted out, because this is actually attributable to the fact that more black cats account for intake into shelters than any other color cats.
Is that because more are born, or do we know?
I don't know. That would be an interesting thing to see if in the United States, if black is a more common color for litters of cats. I always thought sort of brownish tabby was the most common.
Well, being nocturnal animals, there might be certain advantages to, you know, hunting at night. Black.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, you wouldn't have much success as a feline if you were in possession of neon green fur.
Yeah.
Makes it harder to sneak up on the birds.
Oh, no, never mind. So shelters can, we found actually, can often be doing Halloween-themed discounts or events for black cats or orange cats. So there's some shelters that have like taken that myth and said, you know, phooey, it's bunk. We're actually going to play up the Halloween thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it appears to have it be just a hook to get prospective adopters actually thinking about adoption in general. Because any special appears to result in higher adoption rates and more shelter donations, and not just for the target of the special discount. So you could say, like, hey, all adult black cats for the month of October in honor of Halloween have their adoption fee waived. You actually get people coming into the shelter and then saying, oh, I like that guy. Oh, I like this one. And they might go home with a bunny rabbit, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No, that's good. Whatever puts animals in need of a home. In a home, I'm kind of in favor of.
Have you actually heard about reports of mutilated cats and things like that? And, you know, people saying, oh, it must be the Satanists or the pagans doing their rituals.
I have heard those reports. There was something that happened
recently. I believe
I
even passed one on in Facebook about one in Thurston County.
That seems to be something that was happening this particular fall.
Mm-hmm.
But one of these funny things about human bias and our own cognitive biases is that we actually see an animal that appears to have been mutilated. You see a part of an animal maybe on the side of a road, and there's a few more things that are much more likely than humans. One is coyotes, urban coyotes. We certainly have them in most suburban and rural places around the states, and definitely in cities you'll see coyotes.
Or a bunny rabbit that finally had enough.
Maybe. Well, we'll keep that in
that rabbit's in dynamite
reserve. But you know, raptor birds, so eagles and hawks and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, or raccoons even.
Mm-hmm.
And even within the Thurston County case, you know, you did have a lot of house cats that went missing. And then at one point there was a dog carcass that had showed up at a riverbank, mm-hmm. and said, oh my goodness, we think that the cat mutilator has elevated and escalated to dogs. And no, it just actually found out that it was a taxidermist that had inappropriately disposed of the inside of a animal that they were taxiderming.
Humans are very good at spotting patterns, but we're not always accurate in interpreting what the pattern means.
I've heard that described as human brains being a near-all net. It's, we look at near anything random and turn it into something.
And we think that, you know, for a while, that was actually beneficial to our survival, because if you're going to attribute it to some nefarious, if you're going to attribute something creepy to some nefarious purpose, it's going to help the ones survive. It's going to help you survive if it was a nefarious thing, and it won't have an effect. It won't harm you if it wasn't actually a nefarious thing.
It's better to just run from the thing that you think is a tiger in the tall grass rather than trying to conduct a double-blind experiment to find out if it is, in fact, a tiger in the tall grass.
Did it eat me or didn't it?
Exactly.
It's a Schrodinger's caveman?
Yeah.
So I particularly liked the quote of a Baltimore investigator who had actually been hired by Maryland's AG. who had advised police departments in the past on the practices of devil worshippers in particular. And he said that black cats are no more significant than a white dog, a brown dog, or a polka-dotted kangaroo. And he really warned that the more attention that people give to the myth, it just helps, you know, that myth ride along the wave that takes on a life of its own.
Now, yeah. Hold on a second.
And I'm delighted to hear also that humans can sometimes be pretty cool. You know, no, people aren't doing this. Not really, not often.
A polka-dotted kangaroo is pretty significant.
Are you really hung up on that one?
I'm hung up
what?
On it.
Yeah.
Well, maybe your rabid bunny rabbit will will take out the polka-dotted kangaroo.
Well, you know, scientists have come up with a glow-in-the-dark bunny rabbit. They really have.
Oh, you and your genetic engineering.
Wow. Please tell me they called it Energizer. I'm not familiar with this story. I really hope they called it Energizer.
I bet you they did. I didn't hear about the name of it. There's probably a whole strain of them now.
It's splicing in some amazing bioluminescent genes from either sea creatures.
You'd never buy just one battery. Why would you buy just one glow-in-the-dark bunny?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that they're for sale. I think they're engineered in a lab at this point.
Well, probably wouldn't do well out in the wild.
Just another example of capitalism failing us. Can't buy a glow-in-the-dark bunny.
Black cats would find them.
You know, one thing, they would. They absolutely would. So I do want to bring up that, you know, as people will tend to demonize and marginalize, you know, both atheists and supposed pagans or Satan worshipers or things like that as likely candidates for, you know, causing harm to animals. We here at Ask an Atheist, we're animal lovers and animal appreciators. You know, an Arizona Humane Society spokesperson actually noted that Wiccans are actually an anti-cruelty group who often and sometimes hold animals in higher regard than humans. So it's really a very misplaced myth to associate any of this kind of ritualistic abuse of animals with a particular religious bent or on account of someone's non-religiosity.
So that's the long answer. I guess the short answer to the emailed question would be no.
That's the long answer to the question. And hopefully we have answered your questions about all kinds of stuff, whether they be bunny rabbits or anything else. Justin, thank you for joining us today on your first time on Ask an Atheist.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Tom. You can find us at atheist.radio, on Twitter at AskAnAtheistWA, on Facebook.com/AskAnAtheistWA. You can email us questions@atheist.radio. Our music is by Chris Coleman and Phil Whitfield. Executive producer is Sam Mulvey. I'm Becky Friedman, your host for today. See you guys next week.